Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Yai, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
Hi everyone. So before we get started today, I'd like to say a big thank you to the Professional Artists Institute for sponsoring this episode of Art Grind. Their mission is to help artists make a living from their work and basically survive and thrive as an artist so that we don't all have to work multiple jobs in order to support our passion. So if you're anything like me and prefer to spend time in your studio making art rather than marketing your work and kind of concentrating on the business side of things, then check out some of their free trainings at professionalartist.com-free and get a free training on how to get your next art collector. I promise that you will like it and it will help because it helps me. All right, bye everyone. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone. Marshall Jones here with Dina Brodsky, and we just talked to, maybe had one of my favorite interviews of all time, for sure. Like, we talked to Lori Lipton, who was absolutely fantastic. And if you don't know her work, I would call her a genius for sure. Dina, what do you think?
She's amazing. So her art is amazing, but then she also had this, like, I know, completely magnetic, delightful, fun personality. And Marshall, thank you for introducing me to her work. Marshall showed it to me a few months ago and I was like, God, she's really good. And now that I've talked to her, I just want to kind of follow her around the country and be a groupie.
And we picked her brain. We got some secrets. We're all going to be better artists from talking to her. So.
Well, you know what? We are going to be better artists because after talking to her, like, all I want to do is go and draw.
You definitely are people, right? Like, someone who is so technically good, someone who has great ideas, someone who is a lifer for sure, follows this vision. Like, all the people we like to talk to, she might epitomize the ethos of Art Grind.
Yeah, she's a lifer. All right, guys, have fun.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm Marshall Jones here with Dina Brodsky. And today we are interviewing a true genius, Lori Lipton. So Lori, your rendering skills are absolutely phenomenal. And your subjects and how it seems like we're almost looking at photographs inside your head is just so inspiring to me. And so we have a series of questions today to basically steal what makes you a genius, and hopefully we can apply it in our own lives, if that's okay with you.
Lori, we want tips on being a genius, but before
I will give you fabulous tips on being a genius.
Yes.
This is going to be the best podcast ever. But before we start, you know, we ask for tips on being a genius. How did you kind of become the way that you are? Like, were you one of these kids who was always drawing? Like, when did you find yourself as an artist?
I was always drawing, always. In fact, it's a myth in my family that I drew before I could talk, but I couldn't talk till very late in life. So I don't know if that's impressive or not, but I was always encouraged, and that my mother, you know, Jewish mothers are very understated. When she saw my drawing, she went, "Oh my God, you're genius. Oh my God." So I was encouraged to draw, basically.
So this is a strange question, but did you feel like, say, by the time you were in your teenage years from drawing a lot, did you feel sort of like a prodigy? Did you have that label on you? Did you know there's something special?
As I said, understated Jewish parents, I was definitely a child prodigy. I was showing my work at the age of 14. I had a gallery.
Wow.
But I never really thought I was an artist with a capital A. I just thought I drew like other people breathe. You know, it didn't seem special to me. Although my parents, anytime someone came over, they go, look, look, look what Laurie drew, you know, and I go, yeah, okay. And then when they left, my mother would say, well, how does that make you feel? So many people are so impressed. And I would say, well, what are they going to say? You know, I thought they were just buttering me up or just to be, I don't know why I felt like that, but it never went to my hips, as it were. It never went to my ego, which is good because I never tried to please anyone. I was always doing my own thing.
And
along those lines, I mean, I could imagine I've seen some of your very early work and it has quite a bit of edge on it as your work throughout has had. What is generally the reaction to your work when you show it to someone new?
Well, there are people who get me and there are other people who think, oh my God, this woman is sick. Take it away from me. I had a show once. It was with Goya, by the way. I had a show in London with Goya. This is not a humble brag. This is a major brag. And I had top billing. There was Laurie Lipton and Goya. So, and it was work inspired by Goya. And it was at the Cervantes Institute in London. And a guy came over from Spain, handcuffed to lithographs of Goya, because they'd never left Spain before. And my work was showing with him. And one of the pieces that had been inspired by Goya was called Love Bite. And that was from Goya, Saturn eating his son, which is a horrific, you know, painting. But that wasn't in there, by the way, but my love bite was. And a guy came up to me and said, take that down. I mean, just a stranger. I didn't even know him. I wasn't even in charge of, you know, the exhibition. He should have gone to the Cervantes Institute and said, take that down. But no, he said it to me and he was really angry.
What did you say back? Because you don't seem like someone who would bite, you know, demurely look down at the ground and bite your tongue.
I do a lot because I'm very small as a human being. And this man was big and I don't like getting hurt. I'm a survivor. But I said to him, no. And smiled. I smiled.
I know that drawing well. That's the one of the mother biting an infant's head, right? Like that is so intense and just so beautifully rendered that they do give your work gives such a impression. It leaves such an impression on the mind. Like I have recall of your images because they work on two tracks. That is all this hatching, such luminous drawing, and then these super creative, very intense ideas. What do you feel like is more important to you, the rendering or your getting your ideas out?
Oh no, they're meshed together. And my work, it's not realism and it's not surrealism, because surrealism denotes, you know, dream imagery. My imagery is intentional. And someone said it's psychological realism, which, you know, I think it's closer to the truth. I don't know what kind, it's Liptonism. That's how I call it. I mean, it's my own ism. It's the way I need to, it's a controlled passion. I'm doing very passionate, very deep, very emotional subject matter in a very, very controlled way. My drawing technique is fucking insane. It is insane. I wanted to paint the way Jan van Eyck paints. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Absolutely. He's
from the 15th or 14th century. I get it mixed up. You know, after the age of 65, you don't remember a goddamn thing. But anyway, so I wanted to paint in egg tempera like Jan van Eyck. And I tried to teach myself from library books. And I spent a whole lot of money on sable brushes and pigments to try to teach myself. And it went to nothing. And then when I was a poor artist in Europe, I automatically started painting. Egg tempera technique is building up a billion little white lines on board with egg and white pigment. to make the form, and then you glaze the color over, and then you build it up again and you glaze it. So you get an amazing amount of detail. So what I started to do with my drawing, I started to, people think it's cross-hatching. It isn't. It is actually paint. It's egg tempera painting with a pencil. So I'm building up and up and up. So when you see my work on a screen or on your phone, you do not get the idea of what it is like in real life. In real life, it's a gazillion lines and you actually see the lines. You can't see the lines on the computer screen. But when you do, I mean, some of these pieces are 6 foot by 12 foot. So, you know, people come into a show of mine and they just, you know, they're talking to their friends and everything. And then they come into the show and they are struck silent because what they're looking at is mentally insane. It is insane. It isn't, there will never be a forger. There will never be a Lipton forger because it's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Yeah. And I can't, there couldn't be because, it's a mesh, right? It's like layer after layer after layer after layer. That how could you repeat that process?
Wait, Lori, I kind of want to know how you went from being, you know, the kid who drew all the time, whose parents were proud, to the 14-year-old with a gallery, and then to sort of like how did your life develop?
It happened to me. I just let it. I was just drawing, and then things happened. People came to me. And, you know, stuff happened. I got a full scholarship into Carnegie Mellon University, which in those days was only $20, but still was a lot of money, you know. And I went to Europe in my junior year abroad. All this stuff happened. I just was drawing and life happened to me. Basically.
So let's say like your college years, what was that like? Because the kind of drawing you do, I'm not sure. How much was that taught, really? Because from what I know, it wasn't.
Well, I went to Carnegie Mellon University in the mid 70s, and it was all conceptual art there. And my teachers were, one of my drawing teachers used to call me my medieval friend because I wanted to do figurative, and it was all conceptual abstract art in the 70s, in the mid 70s. So I cut my classes and I went to this library and I put on headphones. And I copied the masters I taught myself. I was drawing before this, but I wanted to know about composition. And I taught myself perspective. I still don't know what the hell I'm doing. Can you imagine you go to the best art school in the USA and you had to teach yourself perspective stuff? And I mean, it was just nuts. But they had to pass me. And I made my own curricula. You could only get a degree in drawing. No, in painting or sculpture. That was it for the BFA, big fucking artist. I mean, Bachelor of Fine Arts. So I made my own degree of drawing. I said, this is what I want to major in. And I don't know how but they said, okay. I was the first one in Carnegie Mellon University to graduate with a degree in drawing.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And because I did so much work, they passed me. I mean, I used to show up at the end of the semester with tons of work. I didn't, those classes were so, you know, they used to say to me, you know, make a mark on the paper. That bored the shit out of me. I didn't want to make a mark on the paper. I wanted to make an entire castle on the paper. I wanted to make, you know, they said to me, come in on Tuesday with a self-portrait. So people came in with a thumbprint or a shoe, and then they would talk it out. They'd say, this is my self-portrait because blah, blah, blah. I came in with a drawing of my reflection in a spoon. I mean, because it was difficult to do. So it was bullshit. I thought it was bullshit. And a lot of art today still is bullshit, but I needed to challenge myself always.
So would you consider yourself, even though you went to art school, in your mind, are you self-taught? Would you say everything, you know, that is so insane.
Yeah. It is insane. And thank God I had a full scholarship because if my parents had to pay for that, I would be very, very angry.
No, of course she's self-taught because there wasn't, you know, because I was just like, I was just thinking, I don't know, maybe in the corner of Carnegie Mellon somewhere. So I had, by the way, a very similar college experience to you, except at a less fancy school where, you know, where people are like, you know, that's one of the chair of the painting department actually believed painting was dead. And so I would just skip a lot. And, you know, it was easier to pass me than to, you know, but I had like one teacher who was really good. And that was all it took, that in the library. But it seems like you didn't even have that person. Like it was just you.
Well, no, my professors realized that I was talented. I mean, it oozes out of every pore of me. No, I was passionate. I was passionate and devoted to what I was doing, you know, and they sensed that and they saw it. And I did tons of work. You know, when we went on, there were three of us and they had a junior year abroad program at Carnegie Mellon University where they would exchange students. So we would go, you know, students would go to a university in England or Italy. So three of us made a proposal to the faculty. And what we proposed was we would just travel around Europe, not go to a school, and present a portfolio at the end of our year, and we would get a full year's credit. We never thought they would accept that, but they did. They did accept it. We were all honor students on scholarship. It was nuts. And so, and then when we came back, they had to stop it because everyone wanted to leave. Basically, who wouldn't? I mean, you know, exactly. Pittsburgh or Europe, you know? So, so I went to Europe with two other students and we subdivided very quickly. You know, I went and lived in Aix-en-Provence. I had no money, absolutely no money. That's when I started drawing, like an egg tempera painting, because all I could afford was pencil and paper. I couldn't afford those fancy schmancy sable brushes or anything. And I traveled all over Europe and oh my God, it's like I was saying before with, you know, seeing my drawings on the screen, I'd only seen these paintings in books or sculptures. I went to Florence and I stood in front of Michelangelo's David, and it was the first time I ever cried in public.
Oh, wow.
I was hysterical crying. I just couldn't, it was just too much for me. And then I thought, how can I be an artist? How can I call myself an artist? Look what they've already done. Look at the Uffizi Museum. Look what's already happened. How dare I? How dare I call myself an artist? Oh my God. I went into a deep depression, which is lovely in Europe because, you know, you have a lot of lovely cafes you can be depressed in and you can have coffee, very nice European coffee when you're depressed. And it's fabulous to be depressed in your 20s in Europe. So then I finally came to the conclusion that none of these guys, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Goya, you know, Rembrandt, were Laurie Lipton. None of them. None of them had my life. They were all themselves. And that was their genius. They took their essence and they became so themselves that they became timeless. I could look at their stuff and get affected by them, even in it was the 20th century then. So I thought, That's how I can be an artist. I can just be myself to the nth degree and just follow my art. Not, you know, follow anything else. Not follow fashion. Not follow anybody. Just be me. And so that's how Europe shifted me. And I also realized I did not want to live in the USA. I had to get the fuck out.
So did you? Well,
yes, I handed in my last pay. Oh, first of all, I got a whole life in Aix-en-Provence. I started waitressing. I got a show lined up and I called my mother and I said, Mom, I'm not coming back to finish my BFA. And she said, yes, you are. So I did, because I'm terrified of my mother. And I went back and finished my last year at Carnegie Mellon University. I didn't even stay to get the diploma, you know, with the ceremony. I handed in my last paper and I flew off with my boyfriend to Europe. And we both worked in an experimental theater company. He was the lighting designer and I did all the artwork, camera obscura. And we went around Europe. And that's how I got to back to Europe.
How did you stay true to your vision? Like you said, you know, no one's been Lori Lipton yet. I'm sure there were temptations to sell out. And with your skill set, I'm sure there were easier ways to make money with it than doing your type of images. How do you stay true to yourself?
Well, that's true. You know, I went to galleries with my portfolio in Europe. And everyone said, oh my God, these are amazing drawings, but can you add color? But can you paint? But can you not do something so disturbing so we can sell it? So I waitressed in my 20s and half of my 30s. I worked in a box office. I waitressed in Dutch. I was living in Amsterdam at the time. I was speaking Dutch. So anytime I feel depressed now that my life is too hard or anything, I just think, yes, but you're not waitressing in Dutch. So shut up. So I did everything to keep me on track. And the reason I was able to do that was because I had confidence, because my childhood, because my parents, because everyone around me was encouraging me and saying, oh my God, you know, you're talented, you're a genius. So I didn't think, oh, if only I'd add color, if only I did this, I just stayed on track.
What does drawing mean to you? I heard you say a quote that I thought was really beautiful that was, black and white's the color of thought. I thought that was really like compelling. Like what is it about that medium and stripping the color out of it that works so well for you?
Well, when I was taken to a show of Diane Arbus's photographs when I was about 15, because I did use color pencils before that, and it was in MoMA, and I was, oh my God. First of all, they were just simple. They were photographs of people and black and white and stark. And it was so powerful. If she had used color, it would have made it less powerful. The color makes it less, it would have diluted it. And the reason is color. You know, you can fool people with color. You can do all kinds of things with color. You can mix color. You can color. If it's warm, it makes you feel good. If it's cold, it makes you, you know, you can manipulate people with color. But with black and white, it is stark. It is brutal. And it is there. There is nothing you can. I mean, it is so there. And it's very, very difficult to do as well.
That's great. Do you mind if we talk about, you know, well, many of your paintings, but to start with one, last night I dreamt I murdered mommy. I want to know from a technical aspect, because I hate it when people are like, where do your ideas come from? You know, it's like such a boring question, but like how from conception to getting that, say, in the gallery, technically, how is that done? Are you taking photos and compiling them in some way? I know this was done in the 80s, so there wasn't really Photoshop, but is it like, how do you make these things?
All right. It's very difficult for me to understand that people don't think in images. I said to my mom, you know, I think in images. He said, no, sweetheart, people think in words. That's unusual. So so when I'm sitting drawing, I have my mind flashes images. So if I'm having an emotion, it flashes an image to me. And the way I preserve them, because it keeps going, is I write down a title. So I preserve my images with words. It's upside down. I know it's upside down, but I'm left-handed, so this makes sense somehow. So when I get an image, I will write the title. My titles are very important to me. You know, they're very crucial because when I read the title, I get the image back.
Okay.
It just gives me the image. Whole. And
the image only exists in your head. Like you're just looking at the page that you're working on while you're drawing or whatever. You're not really working with much reference then.
No, if I really need a reference, let's say I need a Dodge Dart car, or let's say I need something technical that I need to do, then I'll get a reference. But I don't like copying a photograph because that to me is boring. I will take the basics of it and then just throw it away. So if I need, let's say I need the shape of a particular car, I will get the shape and then throw the photograph away and just do it. I love sinking in to the shape and the form and the paper. It's like painting. It's very misleading to say these are drawings. They're like graphite paintings. And not mushy paintings either. They're very technically involved paintings.
That's so phenomenal. I mean, what a rare gift you have, honestly. Like it's sort of blowing my mind that you can. Okay, so if that we know technically how you're building it, an image comes into your mind and then you start just going to the canvas and just start drawing. How do you start? Is it shapes? Is it line? How do you build these things?
Well, the first couple of weeks, I just erase because I'm not working from something. So it has to look right. And I've developed this way because I used to live in tiny little rooms, you know, and I couldn't step back. I'd fall out the window if I wanted to step back and look at a drawing. So what I did was I got this mirror and I used to look at the drawing through the mirror, which reverses it and makes you see it differently. And so I would do I call it the cartoon as a line drawing to try to get the drawing correct. I would do the cartoon and erase and erase and erase. And as I said before, I didn't know perspective. I still don't know perspective, which now I like because it looks a little bit off. All my work looks a little bit, which makes it more disturbing. I like that. So, but I can't do like 2-point perspective. I don't know anything anyway. So I use a mirror and I keep erasing and erasing and erasing until I get the cartoon correct. And then I call it coloring it in. I start doing, first I do where's the light source? Where's it coming from? So I establish the light source. I got this all from the early Renaissance painters, by the way, for the composition, the light source, everything is from early Renaissance painting I taught myself. And then I start pushing and pulling back and forth. So the warm colors are my B pencils, the heavy lead, and the cold colors are the H pencils, the hard lead.
Oh,
And I push and pull. I also what was it? I think it was 2002, I discovered charcoal pencil, which a whole new range of colors for me because I see them in color. So, and that's how I work. And I go around and around and around. And then once I get the basics, I just do section by section. And then the drawing changes. I know my work looks very planned out, but it's planned spontaneity. The drawing, the work changes. It's like writing a book. You got the basic plot, you got the basic characters, but then stuff starts happening and then the characters go their own way and things start, and I start weaving stuff and then I go, oh my God, this is where it's going. And I let it happen. I just let it happen.
So by the way, your work, it looks controlled, but not planned out, actually. Like it looks like you're in control of every single second, but like hearing you talk, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. It looks like this drawing is something that evolved kind of over the course of time. I don't look at your work and be like, oh, she had a plan for all of this. You're just in control of everything you do.
It's like my life. I think I'm in control of everything I do, but I get pushed and pulled and I have to go with the flow. Otherwise, I'll get murdered. So that's like my drawing, too. I have a drawing called Leashed Passion. And that's basically what my work is. It's leashed, it's controlled, uncontrollable passion.
How would you describe, say, well, we haven't met each other, but we're at a party and I've just met you, or we're sitting next to each other eating dinner and you're like, I'm an artist. And I'm like, oh, that's great. What kind of art do you do? What would you tell me?
Fabulous art.
Fabulous art. Yeah. Well, I would agree with that. No arguments here.
Okay, you wouldn't just say, how many times have you gotten that question at a party and just tried to dodge it? I used to tell people I was a chartered accountant, just so I wouldn't have to explain what kind of art I make. And it ended the conversation really quick, too, so it had that, you know.
I would never, ever tell somebody I'm a chartered accountant. And if there's any chartered accountants listening, I'm so sorry.
You know, Lori, there probably aren't, but just I know nothing about being a chartered accountant, but just as proof that it ended the conversation really quickly, had anyone actually asked me one follow-up question after that, I wouldn't have been able to answer it. So there was never a single one. It was a conversation stopper.
No, I am very proud of who I am and what I'm creating. I work very, very hard. I've worked all my life. I'm going to be 70 in November. So that means I have been drawing longer than anyone on earth, quite frankly. I mean, some people do draw and they paint and they draw and they sculpt. I just drew for, what is it, 66 years? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, it shows too. Your work is so phenomenal. And I can't believe that these are just images that come to your mind. I find your work it is dark, of course, but talking to you, you're more delightful than I expected. Do you know
that? Wait till you get to know me better.
And I wonder if, does your work, do you find humor in it as well, in the narratives?
Actually, there's a lot of hidden. Look, I'm a Jew from New York. There's a lot of sarcastic humor in there. Mm-hmm. I can't help myself. But, and also I twist, I hide stuff too. You know, a lot of art, modern art, you look at it for 2 seconds and then you move on. You know, there's a red slash, there's rocks on the floor. You move on to the next piece. With my work, you have to actually look at it. In fact, one guy bought one of my drawings and 5 years later, he called me up. He was like hysterical. He was in it, like he was going, oh my God, oh my God, I just found somebody under the table in your work. I mean, it was just, he was crazy, you know, and he was living with it in his, you know, living room. And I hide stuff. You know, it's not just, my work is about stuff that I'm concerned about, that makes me laugh, that it's a whole bunch of things. It's about my life, really.
You know, both your work and actually now you as a person, so you are funny and you are delightful, but both you and your work feel very uncompromising as well. Like people thought that you were extremely talented, but you went to school at a time when this kind of art wasn't taught or encouraged or talked about. And then you actually went through kind of probably most of your life. Like, I feel like only over the last 10 years has like the art world opened up to, you know, anything that's not, maybe 15 years, like anything that's not kind of this highly conceptually driven, whatever it was in the 70s, right? So I feel like recently it's probably easier, but you've spent your whole life, it's almost like going against the grain and probably thriving doing this. And talking to you, I'm like, oh, I see how this happened. It's because you're like this.
Yeah, no. The only thing I'm sure about, well, aside from the fact that I will die eventually, is that I can draw, period. Everything else I'm unsure about, everything, relationships, life, everything. But these two factors I am definitely sure about, and those have sustained me. Well, death has also sustained me because, you know, it's so, life is so transient. And that's why I'm working like a maniac. I don't, you know, I love drawing and I have to get in as many as I can. You know, at the moment, because I'm going to be 70, God knows how long I have. So I'm doing this 20-foot drawing at the moment because God knows how long I'll be healthy enough to do this. You know, I have a very healthy lifestyle only because I want to draw till I'm 111. I've focused on that number because it's a nice number, 111. I like that number. And that's the only reason I'm eating healthy. I don't drink. I don't smoke. Is because I love drawing, period.
Wow. Could we talk about another one of your drawings in particular that you use color and the disasters of war with those atrocities going on a color screen with person watching it all in black and white? What was your decision for color in that one?
That was from the Sleep of Reason show with Goya. I took all the titles from Goya's pieces and then reinterpreted them. And the disasters of war was something that Goya had lived through in Spain. He saw people being, you know, executed, shot, and he drew about it. And then I was seeing the Iran war. It was the Iraqi war. Oh, see, I can't even remember anything anymore on TV. And it came to the image came to me in color. You know, black and white, and the TV, because of the blood, because of the suffering. And it was just this, the black and white cold reality and the TV showing the color suffering was how I experienced, I was watching war in real time on CNN and eating my supper. It was so weird, you know, seeing people suffer while I'm in my home eating supper. So that dichotomy between, you know, the two worlds, that's why the color was necessary.
Well, it is. That's what it communicated to me, because it's such a strange thing that we as modern people see all these horrific images every day, and then we just sort of like walk outside and the sky's blue where we're just birds are chirping. It's like such a schizophrenic existence, like seeing all these things, trying to digest them, but they're not happening in my backyard right now. You know what I'm saying? It's like very jarring, and that's what that communicated to me.
Well, also what I'm doing now is I'm getting more and more political as I get older, and how can I help it? Look what's going on. But so I post on social media a lot, you know, that's how I get my work out there now. And I posted this thing saying, you know, on July 4th, the earth was hotter than any time on earth. And, you know, this is, you know, we're burning up, you know, we are so screwed. And I posted this drawing that I'm doing. It's a triptych, like the Van Eyck painting is a triptych, you know, of it's called Smoke, and it's all the smoke coming out of these industrial complex. And people just said, it's, you know, the earth has been hot before, and I'm just, you know, people are just so immune to what we're doing to ourselves, and they just get on their phone. Or maybe like me, I can't say that I am guiltless. I just posting on social, they post a meme on social media. Oh, look, we're burning up. But no one's going out there and going, you know, stop. Mm-hmm. No one is. So yeah, we're just allowing ourselves to become extinct. You know, whatever.
I can't remember. Actually, I do remember where this quote is from. I can't remember the quote properly, but it's from, have you read The Overstory by Richard Powers?
No.
You'll really like it. You'll like it because it deals with some of the stuff that you're talking about. I like it because it's about trees, but it's one of those books where if you try to describe it to someone, it sounds incredibly boring. And if you actually read it, it's brilliant. This isn't our earth. It's not an earth with people in it. It's a world of trees where people have just come in the last, you know, 15 seconds. And we're sort of like, you know, we're using up these resources that were, you know, kind of accumulated over, you know, billions of years, and we're burning them up in, you know, like in a second of our existence. I butchered that entire thing. I think I conflated several of us close, but you should read the book. It's great.
Get the gist. Yes. And it's true. It's true.
So by the way, what is your life like right now? I mean, like, you're obviously very committed to one thing, but let's say you wake up in the morning, then what happens?
I wake up in the morning. I do my social media with my breakfast. I try to answer everybody. I remember when I was in my 20s and I wrote to this artist who did pencil drawings, I had to actually mail the fucking letter. I mean, there was no internet or anything then. It was when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth and we had to actually, you know, wait for responses. So I wrote to this guy. I loved his drawing book. And I said, well, how did you do this? And I wrote to him and I sent off the letter. And he responded, like a month later? I don't know. But he said, if you pay me $50, I will tell you.
Whoa.
And I want you to know there's karma, because what was it, like 6 years later, I was a judge for a drawing show and he was one of the people who was trying to get in. Anyway, I digress. So I try to answer every person on my social media, especially young artists, you know. So I do that. And then I go, maybe I do my shopping or something. And then I can't say I get to work, because it isn't work for me. Waitressing in Dutch was work. And working in a box office was work. But this is sheer bliss. And I sit down at my drawing table or at this 20-foot thing that I'm doing now. And I don't know if there is a God. I don't know we could be in a video game. I have no idea what's going on. But I thank the universe. And then I start drawing because I'm so lucky. I get to draw all day, every day. Very lucky.
And you said earlier that, because I wrote it down, compulsion, like you feel like an artist compelled to do things. And I heard you at the beginning of our conversation say you don't feel compulsive. How do you distinguish the difference there from someone working all the time and just feels like you're on a quest to produce as much beautiful work as you can successfully, by the way? Why do you think you're not compulsive?
Well, compulsive denotes a kind of psychological state of being. And what I'm doing is bliss. And I'm delusional, but emotionally very good and very mature for my state of mind or whatever. I am good. I'm happy. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. And I'm living out a childhood dream. I used to pray, you know, wish on a star that I didn't have to go to school and I could just draw all day, every day. I wish I'd also said, and can I be a millionaire? But, you know, I was stupid. So it's not a, you know, if I have to go help a friend, or if I have to go on a trip somewhere, or I'm good, you know, it's, but the fact that I get to do what I want to do is not compulsion, it's bliss.
Okay, I get it. So compulsion for you has the connotation of there being something wrong driving you, whereas what you're talking about is there's something right driving you. This is exactly what you want. So, you know,
is that Hitchcock's film Compulsion? Was Hitchcock?
I don't know. I once curated a show called Compulsion, and it had all of those people that just can't stop, that will take something as far. And that's the kind of work that I loved. So I thought of it as what Marshall said, just right, being held to keep going, because that's, you know, like, to me, that's, it's what brings me joy as well. Did you feel like kind of going through life, being the kind of artist you are and going against the grain a little bit, do you feel like the business side of art was a struggle, or did you kind of find, you know, you didn't become a millionaire, but you're obviously doing what you want all day, which, you know.
That's another beef I have, that they didn't teach you how to read a contract at art school. I mean, that is 50% of being an artist is galleries, contracts, sales. They didn't teach me anything like that. And I've been so screwed by so many galleries, and not in a good way, all my life. This is the first time since COVID that I haven't had a gallery in my life. And I feel so good. But I need a show, and I do want a show. If anyone's listening who happens to have a museum or know someone who has a museum, because showing your work en masse, you know, in a big room is very impressive, you know, instead of selling it one at a time. But I was very, very naive.
I have my own theory about this, but I kind of want to hear yours. Like, when I think of your work, I think of it as like the work we should all aspire to be doing, just sort of the top of the hill. And so you would think if the art world were like a meritocracy, you would be one of the most well-known people out there. And why do you think you're not as well-known as other people in that way?
First of all, bless you, my darling. It's not what you do, it's who you know. And I learned that too late in life, because I didn't spend all my time schmoozing. I spent all my time drawing. And that was not good. All the artists who are up there in the museums know people and have schmoozed, period.
Because so much crap gets up there. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a real... It's so difficult, like, just that, the unequalness, how it feels like effort isn't always rewarded or skill isn't always rewarded. Like you said, it's who you know. And sometimes you go to a museum, see some artwork, you're excited to go, and you're just like, God, like, what is happening? Like, if
I feel like it's almost not only is it not a meritocracy, right? I feel like it's almost the opposite of it, right? Because you get good at what you do a lot of, right? So let's say you've got two Laurie Liptons, right? You know, let's say you had an evil twin, right? Who's actually just as good as you are at age, you know, 14, 18, 21. But evil Laurie, or maybe just socialite Laurie, starts spending more and more of her time going to openings and trying to meet the right people, trying to sort of like climb that ladder. This Laurie is going to keep getting better at drawing, which, you know, because you're going to be in your studio drawing 12 hours a day, so you'll get better. And the other Laurie will get better at, you know, climbing, because that's what she's doing all day. And so when you've got, you know, when you look, let's say that the two Lauries reunite in 10 years, you'll have one person that got really, really good at drawing. And then you've got another person that actually maybe didn't draw as much and got really, really good at this other aspect of, like, you know, at like maneuvering. And that Laurie's not going to be as good at drawing, actually, but she'll be a better social climber.
No, the other Laurie will be very, very wealthy and hopefully will keep me.
What do you think the hardest part of drawing for you is?
Not drawing.
Okay.
Great answer. What's the easiest part about drawing?
Oh, the easiest part about drawing is sitting down in front of a blank piece of paper with a ginormous cup of tea. So listen, I lived in England for 26 years. That's why I have a ginormous cup of tea. And Earl Grey. And just starting. And then the next best thing is getting all the lines in order and just putting on headphones, putting on music, and going bye-bye.
What do you listen to when you draw?
Oh, it depends on what I'm drawing, and it depends on my energy level. So I listen to my parents used to blast Ella Fitzgerald and opera and Peter, Paul, and Mary. And so I have such an eclectic taste in music. I mean, I'm just all over the place, blues, jazz. I just have everything. And sometimes I just listen to podcasts if I just need my brain to go bye-bye, because sometimes my brain starts talking to me and I need it to shut up. So I have somebody else talking to me instead. So I listen to a podcast. And I just, anything to just let me relax and sit there and enjoy.
So if there's potential young artists who are listening, of whom I think there's a lot listening to this podcast, right, who want to live the kind of life that you've led, and because the life that you've led is actually magical, like you're not a millionaire, but you've been able to live without compromising and do the kind of work that you do without compromising on that or what's trendy or what's fashionable, what advice would you give, you know, yourself from however many years ago?
It's funny. A lot of kids like 20s and 30 year olds contact me on my social media sites and they go, well, what kind of pencil do you use? What kind of paper do you use? You know, and I say to them, Bubby, Bubula, it's not the pencil. It's not the paper. You have to go into a room, close the door and draw for 64 years. Then you will get me. Then you will get the kind of technical skill. It's not magic. It's work. It's work, work, work. And unless you're so driven, it's like, let's say a world-class pianist or a violinist. How did they get there? Work, work, work. It's not magic. It's very simple. If you want something, you have to work at it. It's not going to just drop on your head from the sky, although some things do drop on your head from the sky and they're not good. So it's just desire. If your desire is strong enough. So I had a waitress. I had to do all this shit. I wasn't able to just draw automatically, but I fit it into my life. I put my life around it, basically.
Did you ever wind up teaching?
No, but I do do guest lecturing and stuff for art students. It was so funny when I was invited to Cal State Fullerton when I was living in London. And in London, everyone says fuck. It's just what everyone says. I mean, they say things like, you know, how the fuck are you? And I go, oh, you know, fucking fine. How the fuck are you? You know, it's just natural. So I was invited to Cal State Fullerton. And I was as a guest lecturer to, you know, graduate art students, you know. And I get up there and I say, somebody asked me a question. I said, well, this is fucking. And I saw the room jump when I said fucking. And I went, wow, art students is so conservative in California. Wow. So then I said every other word was fuck because I liked seeing them jump. But I love talking to kids about art. I love art, basically, period.
Who is your favorite artist of all time?
Yeah, you see. No, you see, I can't.
That one's not fair.
That's not fair. But, you know, I've gone through phases. You know, just recently, you know, so many museum shows and people go, you got to see this. And I go and I get depressed, you know, like you said. And then a friend of mine said, you have to see this show. And he took me in. It was Kerry James Marshall. Mm. And I started crying because I get very moved if it's very, very good. And he not only has a technique, he has something to say. It has to be both things. It's not just the technique, you know? It's not just copying a photograph and going, oh, look how good I am. It's something to say, you know? So that's my most recent favorite is Kerry James Marshall. But I mean, there's a whole, like a shitload of people that have inspired me over the years that have gone into my soul. It's soul food. It makes you grow as a human being. Art is not only for artists. It makes you grow as a human being, this stuff.
I agree with that 100%. A past guest we had, I think it was J.P. Roy, was saying that they're little empathy generators, paintings and stuff, because you look at them and you get a sense of who that person is, like a Kerry James Marshall, what their life is like. And it's almost like in your work in particular, you feel like you're in your head. You feel like these are photographs that are popping out of your brain. And it's like, it's nice to look through that lens.
Actually, the last show that I saw that I still think about was, Marshall, do you remember last year we went to see that Holbein show and I made you Yeah. And do you remember I made you leave after like 45 minutes? Because I think I got physically kind of, it was so good that I got physically kind of like nauseous. Like I couldn't be there anymore because every single painting felt like it was better than everything that I have created and will create during the course of my entire life.
Yeah, hold on. Now you're talking turkey. I mean, really. And it's good to feel that. That's the thing. Once you get self-satisfied, you stop growing. You know, I'm pushing myself still. I mean, I'm doing this 6'10" by 20-foot long drawing because I think I can't do it. That's why I'm doing this. You got to push because otherwise you just get smug, basically.
And is that a huge drawing in the exact same like method you're using on the other one, just so hyper articulated?
Yeah, I mean, I'm using more charcoal pencils, which is not the fine point. You know, I usually use a click pencil, which is a tiny little eensy weensy point. But with this kind of drawing, I still do the same technique of overlay, but the point isn't as thin. I mean, otherwise I'd never be seen again ever. And you'd see the skeleton in there.
With clutching clutching your mechanical pencil. Have you ever tried the pure lead pencils?
Yeah, of course. I've tried everything, sweetheart.
Okay, you've tried every pencil. All right, cool. I'm talking to the master. I actually just tried one for the first time recently, and I was like, God, this covers so much space.
That's lovely.
So by the way, Lori, if people wanted to see your work live, which I kind of want to do right now, because I like them on the internet, but really, like nothing is as good on the internet, but where would people go?
That's the problem. I don't have a solo show at the moment. I've had shows. I had a show in Paris in a little museum at the foot of Montmartre. I had a piece in London. I have a piece here and I have a piece there. But there's no solo shows planned. And that's what I'm trying to get. It's very difficult because the pandemic really screwed up a lot of schedules and stuff. So I don't know. I'm at the moment, I don't know. If I do get a show somewhere, I will post it on my website and or my social media or both, most probably.
But could you give those addresses to listeners? They'll find you. I follow you on Instagram. What's your Instagram name and your website address?
Well, I think my Instagram is at Lori Lipton Drawings. Yeah, it is. And my website is laurielipton.com. That's L-A-U-R-I-E, not L-O-R-I. Please, no.
That's not a real Lori.
Well, Lori, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the gift you give to us all through bringing your mind on paper and allowing us to enjoy it. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Marshall. And thank you, Dina. I love talking about art. So thank you for the pleasure of it.
No, thank you. Great. And honestly, yeah, if you're ever in Boston or New York, I come to New York to hang out with you. I know where all the good cups of tea are.
Good. Oh, but no, when I go out, I drink coffee. So that's okay.
I know those.
Yeah. And also, you know, in Boston, New York, if you know somebody who knows somebody in a museum, let me know.
We'll definitely, they're.
You know, are you looking for a museum or a gallery? Because I don't know the people in charge of museums, but I probably, I know a lot of galleries. What are you?
You know, a gallery that's intimate with a museum, I might consider
okay.
it.
Okay.
We'll try to pull some straight. We're on Team Lori here, so whatever we can do, we'll
pull. Don't just sit there. Do something. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Fantastic.
If you enjoyed this episode and you are a visual artist, you can help us keep costs of producing the Nyx podcast to zero by supporting our sponsor. Just go to professionalartist.com/free and access a free training on how to get your Nyx art collector. That's professionalartist.com/free. And that link will be in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertained you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG at ArtGrindPodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.